Indeed, their relative positions drew the same irregular pentagon as the fort's walls, if one were to look at them with a bird's eye view. They probably lined up like that subconsciously, like a natural compass, or a homing insect of some sort. Whatever it was, it compelled them to be even a few steps closer to their respective trunks, hence their arrangement.
To think it was something like that. And here I thought your maternal instincts were kicking in.
What?
Kira was taken aback.
I mean, you hit it off so well with them, it's almost like they're your actual kids. I'm sure you'll make a great mother someday.
Yeah.
The catgirl's dispirited response and diminishing smile seemed to raise the ire of the dryads, who glared at Fayhorn with angry frowns. For the briefest moment, the ranger felt like he saw the titanic trees in the distance shift slightly out of the corner of his eye. The distant rumbling was barely audible even to his excessively sharp ears, and even more worrisome. Thankfully, nothing of real consequence happened as his pupil trotted off towards her quarters. The quintuplets followed, though it was impossible not to notice that she no longer had that spring in her step.
Hey, Kira, heading back to the barracks?
The beastkin passed by Leah on the way, but responded to the elf girl's greeting with a lazy wave of her hand and a lifeless,
hey, yeah.
Noticing her friend's sour mood, her green-haired classmate looked in the direction she came from, and her eyes met Fayhorn's dumbfounded stare. She approached the old ranger with a displeased look, and the man braced for an argument.
Mr. Fayhorn, what did you do to upset Kira so badly?
Sure enough, the first thing Leah did was accuse him of wrongdoing.
For the last time, Miss Torley, I don't bully my students for my own amusement.
He frowned at her unspoken accusation. True, he was a strict and uncompromising teacher, but it was for their own good. The life of an adventurer was harsh, and he prepared the youngsters harshly. This method had been doubly necessary with this unfortunate war business looming over everyone's heads.
Of course.
Leah backtracked a little.
Still, you clearly said something that hurt her feelings.
I did no such thing. We just had a brief chat regarding those dryads, and then she started sulking when I complimented her on being a good mother figure to them.
Leah closed her eyes, drooped her shoulders, and sighed heavily. She had stepped in that particular trap herself earlier that day. Kira felt rather depressed that she'd never have children of her own. After all, her romance with Rowana would never bear that sort of fruit, no matter how intense or passionate they felt. The two of them couldn't even adopt unless they were officially married, which was unlikely to happen when considering the current laws and culture of the Republic. Of course, there was no way Fayhorn would know all this, and Leah didn't feel like explaining it to him. Not only would spilling the beans on Kira's private life be a violation of her trust, but she was sure he wouldn't understand and would somehow make things worse if she told him.
Honestly, this is why men are.
In the end, she just walked off while muttering under her breath and shaking her head, leaving the old elf in an even more confused state of mind.
What? He asked the air around him. What did I say?
Chapter 6. Veni, Vidi, Edi. Part 1. Fort Yemen was built within the only hilt tree grove in the Clattering Plains, which consisted of exactly 5 of the titanic trees. It stood out like a sore thumb amidst the grassy open fields surrounding it for at least a dozen kilometers in every direction. The fort existed on that spot for 300 years, yet hadn't been attacked even once. Though there were numerous armed conflicts between the Lodrak Empire and Ishigar Republic since its construction, the border had simply been too far away for the fort to be in any real danger. However, on this morning, that centuries-old eyesore would finally be put to its intended use. The Empire had arrived with a force of 30,000 soldiers, who were currently forming ranks on the surrounding plains. Fort Yemen's defenders lined up atop and behind the walls. None of them were strangers to combat, but this would be the first real taste of open warfare for many. It was only natural they would be nervous or frightened. Such individuals were few and far between among these 13,000 defenders. Over half of them were professional soldiers belonging to the Third Republic Legion. Another 2,000 were part of the garrison detachment normally stationed at the fort. These troops had been temporarily assimilated into the Legion's command structure. The remaining 4,000 were adventurers drafted into service by the government. Compared to the opposing force, over twice the size and comprised entirely of military personnel, they were outclassed and outnumbered. Yet, most of them were calm and resolute. A single glance at one of the titanic hilt trees was enough to fill them with the courage to push down their fear. They had five of the legendary dryads on their side. A simple glance at the stoic, unflinching hilt trees was enough to help steel their hearts and minds for what was to come. It was atop a relatively low, but practically high, branch that Fayhorn made his roost. He used his skills to carefully observe the enemy and reported what he saw through the comm crystal in his hand. He looked without having to aim, which allowed him to focus entirely on peering into the distance to such a fine degree that he could easily see the faces of people that were over a kilometer away.
"I've confirmed the presence of three VIPs," he said matter-of-factly. "One of them's that holy necromancer, and he's got his own division of roughly 100 death knights."
The man in question was draped head to toe in a long, pale robe with bits of metal armor on top. A hood covered his ashen hair, while a cloth mask concealed all but the pale skin around his dull red eyes. His arms held onto a bone staff that was modeled to look like a scythe. As for his rather absurd moniker, that was something he earned because of the rather unorthodox way he practiced necromancy. For one thing, he always made sure to get permission before using a corpse, either from the individual themselves while they were still alive, or from their next of kin. He then performed secret rituals to sanctify the remains before reanimating them. All in all, it was a long-winded process that was lengthy and expensive, but the result was the creation of hallowed dead. One could easily tell these apart from regular undead because their forms and armor were bleached pure white, as opposed to the dark and gloomy hues one would expect. Not only that, but the living didn't feel any of the revulsion one would expect. The hallowed dead weren't particularly stronger or tougher than regular undead, but the nature of their creation gave them two distinct advantages. The first was that their master would not suffer the wrath of Mortimer, god of death and commerce, and could avoid being branded with the stigma of taboo. The other was that these hallowed dead were far less vulnerable to holy and fire magic, mitigating the undead's major weakness.
"The second is the loose cannon, Lyrian," Fayhorn continued his report.
This one was known to be a dangerous wizard that specialized in long-range, wide-area magical attacks. He was essentially a piece of artillery that walked on two legs. He was one of the few VIPs whose ultimate skill was known, a nasty piece of magic called particle cannon. It was an energy beam powerful enough to punch a hole clean through Fort Yemen's walls in one go, perhaps even breaching the keep itself.
"The last confirmed sighting is that Black Tower fellow, Ruklunda."
Next in the ranger's sights was a shaman whose nickname came from his towering build, dark skin, and tendency to fight topless. His upper body was covered in various ritualistic tattoos and markings. His weapon of choice was a massive wooden pillar almost as tall as him with various animal shapes carved into it like a totem pole. What truly set him apart from the others was that he was known to be an adventurer and wasn't technically part of the Imperial Army. It was unclear how the Empire persuaded him to show up, as his reputation made it clear he wasn't easily motivated by gold or glory. In fact, the Republic's Foreign Intelligence Bureau had at one time suspected him of being the Sandman due to his abnormally large build and altruistic nature. That theory had gone out the window the instant the vigilante had sent the elves his invoice. But that was beside the point.
"I see a possible fourth one,"
Fayhorn added as he peered at the enemy formations.
"A woman in dark-colored light armor and a blue tabard. She's holding a metal staff, black with gold-colored detailing at both ends. I can't see much of her face because of that hood she has on, but the insignia on her shoulder is clearly that of the Gilded Hand."
"Understood,"
Underwood answered through the cube in his hand.
"Keep an eye out for the remaining two."
The fifth VIP the Republic expected was a certain nobleman with a questionable reputation, a warlock that went by the name of Arakawa Shinji. He was supposed to be an old man in a dark robe accompanied by a demonic entourage, but the elf saw no one that fit the description. There were quite a few warlocks with familiars among their ranks, but none of them really stood out. Typically, the VIPs would receive preferential treatment and be put up on a pedestal to inspire the troops around them. If Shinji chose to hide away among his lower-leveled colleagues, confirming his presence was impossible by sight alone. Far less was known about the Empire's sixth and final powerhouse. In fact, the only information the FIB unearthed about him was that he was a dwarven adventurer who had no affiliations with the military or the nobility. Fayhorn made a token attempt to locate anyone who fit that description, but gave up soon after. He instead focused his efforts onto trying to spot any deception or ruse within the Empire's movements. It seemed, however, that they were not planning anything clever, as they finalized their formations and began a steady march towards the fort. Their blue tabards, cloaks, robes, and flags with griffin imprints clearly demonstrated their allegiance. Even the demons, undead, and war beasts had some blue trappings or war paint. This was good, because those dryads struggled to tell people apart based on facial features, something Fayhorn found slightly ironic when considering they all looked identical. Kira was the only one with a firm grasp on which of them was which, though that was hardly surprising. She'd spent nearly every waking moment of the past few days with those immature tree spirits, after all. As for the Beastkin's role in the siege, she was to be a coordinator far from the front lines. She was presently nestled somewhere in the trees along with the dryads in question, and it was her job to make sure they stuck to the plan without going berserk. Their trees were bound to suffer some damage, so they might take action on their own if she wasn't around to hold them back. Fayhorn suspected the catgirl was just worried about them and wanted to be there to guide them through this turbulent time. His lips curled into a smile as he once again thought she'd make a truly great wife and mother someday. Though he kept his opinion to himself. Such idle thoughts swam around the back of his mind as he watched the steadily approaching enemy force. As expected, about half of them were durable close combat units. The rest were split between magical support, healers, and what was left of their rogues and rangers. Fayhorn and his scouts may not have been able to do much to stall them over the past week, but had still racked up nearly 500 confirmed kills altogether. Once the Imperial Army passed the 300-meter mark, both sides deployed a number of large-scale magical barriers to protect themselves from long-distance attacks. In the Empire's case, they relied on personnel, while the Republic used large barrier-generating magic items built into the fortifications. The latter were stronger and had more MP stored up than the former, but were too large and heavy for the invading force to have them along.
Archers at the ready!
A dozen loud voices rang out among the silence that gripped Fort Yemen, followed by a momentary avalanche of clattering as 7,000 arrows were knocked. Even though it may not have been the main weapon of choice for all of them, the vast majority of elven soldiers had received training in using a longbow and had at least 15 levels in the ranger job. It would be foolish to limit an able-bodied fighter to just close-ranged weaponry, after all.
Take aim!
The ones atop the walls lined up their shots, while those on the ground behind them aimed at the sky. Even if their attributes sucked, even if the power behind their shots was weak, even if their aim was lacking, even if they couldn't see their intended targets, none of that mattered in a siege. As long as they shot in the general direction of the enemy, they were bound to hit something. Admittedly, these blind attacks would accomplish very little in the grand scheme of things, but it was better to have them than not. When the forefront of the enemy vanguard crossed the 150-meter mark, the battle finally began in earnest.
Loose!
A sea of arrows flew up into the air, glimmering with various colors as numerous enhancements, martial arts, and other effects imbued power into each projectile. They passed effortlessly through the massive one-way barriers around the fort and drew grand arcs through the air before raining down on the approaching Imperial forces. The Imperial wizards, priests, and shamans gritted their teeth as the onslaught of projectiles clashed against their defensive spells. The outcome was the total deflection of the first volley at the cost of the caster's collective MP.
Loose!
The second volley came several seconds later, once more filling the air with crackling sparks as countless arrows smashed into the projected barriers.
Loose!
A third volley followed, then a fourth, and a fifth. The repeated strain on the Empire's magic users became apparent as their defenses waned. Of course, the attackers, rangers, and rogues fired back, but they lacked the firepower to punch through the fort's tougher barriers. Then, on the sixth volley, the protective spells above the center of the Imperial army caved in. There were numerous sounds like glass shattering as the defensive spells were broken one after the other, and the arrows finally reached the soldiers underneath. They raised their shields and braced themselves, but still suffered injuries. Various hit confirmation messages flooded the minds of the Republic troops, signifying the spells had broken through.
Fayhorn, you're up.
Up in the lower branches of the hilt tree, a certain comm crystal relayed the orders that its owner had been waiting for.
Snipe!
Immediately after, his spectral arrow shot forward like a beam of light, instantly piercing one of the Empire's priests through the head. Hundreds of similar blue streaks of light flew out of the surrounding canopy, targeting physically weak magic users. The soldiers in front attempted to cover for their comrades using their shields and various skills, but the high angle of the attacks rendered most of their efforts moot. A number of the robe-wearing twinkle fingers resorted to quite literally crawling between the armored grunt's legs.
Snipe, 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 snipe.
Even that seemingly cowardly act wouldn't save them from the stream of arrows flowing from Fayhorn's nest. Snipe was a martial art that imbued a ranger's shots with immense penetrative power and speed. As expected of a level 100 wielding an artifact-grade bow, his attacks punched clean through shields, armor, and people as if they were paper. He also took potshots at the VIPs, but their defenses were far more formidable. The Imperial army suffered casualties, but endured as the distance between them and the walls shortened to about 60 meters. Meteorites of fire, comets of ice, and solidified lumps of darkness rained down from the heavens on both sides as their pyromancers, cryomancers, wizards, and warlocks traded long-range spells. The fort's barriers deflected all of the invaders' magic while the attacking forces' unevenly distributed defenses only blocked about half of them, resulting in heavy damage to the Imperial infantry. The Republic was definitely ahead in this early exchange since they had the fortified position, but it wouldn't last for long. Siege weapons were completed with dizzying speed at the far back of the Imperial formation. These unleashed a barrage of enchanted stones that slammed heavily against the fort's magical defenses, then burst into shockwaves of thunderous force that rattled the bones and shook the soul. The repeated onslaught caused large cracks to spread through the bubble-like shields, a sign they were about to break. The fervent exchange of arrows and spells hadn't yet ceased, but the Empire's foot soldiers had reached the base of the walls all the same. While all of that was going on, a certain cat-eared beastkin sat cross-legged amidst a mess of bark and leaves with five childlike dryads huddled around her. The three of them closest to the invading force gritted their teeth as their exposed trunks received damage from a myriad of sources. Of course, they would be hit. They were the quite literal cornerstone of the base's fortifications, so it was only natural the Empire's attacks would affect them even if they weren't the focus of the offensive.
Mummy, it's itchy!
One of them whined.
I know, sweetie.
Kira comforted her.
Please bear with it a while longer.
Although they appeared as just giant trees at first glance, hilt trunks were actually far, far sturdier than any stone walls or magical barriers. The dryad still felt the arrows, spells, and stones crashing against their iron bark, but it was only at the stage of irritation and itchiness. They probably didn't even take any actual damage. If this was all there was to the Empire's offensive, then it wouldn't have been enough to rouse the quintuplets from their slumber had they not been awakened by the authority. The blue crystal cube in Kira's hands lit up, and she answered it to find herself staring at the projected image of Vera, the prefect in charge of Fort Yemen.
Decanus, begin phase one,
the officer ordered.
Yes, ma'am.
Kira saluted, then turned to the dryads.
All right, girls. It's time to play catch with the blue people.
Yay!
The dryads cried out in unison. Far below them, on the ground within the fort's walls, was a freshly planted grove of young hilt trees with a myriad of large stones and rocks strewn around them. The 5-meter-tall seedlings began moving and bending like clay as their trunks and branches creaked. The elves immediately cleared the area and got out of the way. The trees bent over and grasped at the rocks with their branches as if they were gigantic hands and fingers. The saplings flung those stones and boulders into the air with enough force to very nearly uproot themselves. Their haphazard trajectories easily cleared the walls and rained down on the Empire's unsuspecting troops, injuring or killing hundreds of them in the first volley. A squad of druids within the so-called catapult garden quickly used their magic to heal the disturbed soil and revitalize the young trees, which bent over and repeated the process. This phenomenon was possible because of control vegetation, a dryad-exclusive skill that served as their main form of offense. It wasn't just their own bodies, but pretty much any non-sentient plant within their root's reach that could bend to their will. Considering an ancient hilt tree's root system could span kilometers in every direction, it went without saying that the entirety of Fort Yemen fell within their range. Back outside the walls, the Empire was steadily gaining ground. A large number of the barriers protecting the defenders had shattered, and the Republic soldiers had to deploy their own magical defenses. The invading army pretty much crashed against the thick, 10-meter-tall stone walls like a battering ram. Those at the front were already busy attacking the enchanted fortification using maces and warhammers, while powerful spells crashed against its surface overhead. Even if it was little by little, they steadily chipped away at the fortifications. Of course, the Republic would not let them have their way so easily.
All right, boys!
Fizzy's metallic voice rang out.
I think those meatbags outside need a bath.
Yes, ma'am!
A dedicated squad of siege engineers replied in unison as they began ferrying pots of boiling oil up the stairs and onto the walls. The elves already up on the ramparts made way for them, and the scalding mixture was dumped onto the soldiers below. The cries of pain rose up from their ranks as proof of the oil's effectiveness, but that was only the first step. With practiced ease, the siege engineers took a number of stick-like bombs out of their pockets and pouches, pulled the pins, and threw them over the edge. The metal tubes burst open not with explosive force, but bright yellow flames. The alchemically prepared boiling oil below caught fire, enveloping the base of the walls in a raging, persistent inferno. Heavy brown smoke rose from the flames and lingered around the area like a thick smog, choking the life out of anything that still drew breath. Artificers and alchemists both made nasty stuff on their own, but the combination of the former's ingenuity and the latter's deadly chemicals was truly gruesome. Just then, a plume of bright, blue light radiated from somewhere within the Empire's ranks. The man known as the Loose Cannon was charging his signature move. The Republic forces launched attacks at him to interrupt it, but the Empire's magic users converged around him to provide cover. It was a tense few moments, but the attacker's efforts proved enough.
Particle Cannon!
A conical beam of pure energy shot out from the man and flew towards the walls of Fort Yemen at near light speed.
Mirror of Calandra!
Split seconds before it hit, a gigantic, oval-shaped ornamental mirror sprang up in front of the walls. The beam bounced off it and washed over that section of the Empire's forces. It scorched the ground and turned hundreds of the invaders to ash within the blink of an eye. Feat of Strength performed. You have unlocked a new perk, Slayer of Humanity. This was the only noteworthy message amidst the flood of notifications that assailed Imiril's consciousness. The power of the Ascendant Human's particle cannon had been reflected by that of the High Elf's own ultimate skill. The Loose Cannon himself had been caught up in the attack, though he barely managed to survive. The two high-level wizards glared at each other across the momentarily silenced battlefield. Lyrian clicked his tongue.
I wasn't told that bitch would be there.
Had he known, he wouldn't have thoughtlessly used his ultimate skill like that. Not only were most of his direct subordinates dead, but his MP was nearly exhausted and his HP wasn't in great shape either. This seemed to be a good point for him to fall back and recuperate. No matter how weak or powerful they were, any individual on this world would be able to heal from their non-crippling injuries and return to battle after a 10-to-15-minute rest. This time could be cut even shorter with the aid of restorative magic and elixirs. The injured troops still wouldn't be able to use any powerful skills that had excessively long cooldown periods and had to manage their stamina, but for the most part they could get right back to the fight. None of that was relevant to the Ascendant Wizard, however, as a spectral arrow bore a hole clean through his heart. A second one pierced his skull before his body had even hit the ground.
"Confirmed kill on Lyrian," Fayhorn reported from his perch.
"Good work,"
Underwood replied.
"Thank Imeril if you have time to blab, Silas."
If it hadn't been for the High Elf's perfectly executed counter-ultimate, bringing that man down would have been a much more difficult task. Breaching his mana shield alone would have taken far too much time for a lone ranger, even one of Fayhorn's level.
"Heads up, the hallowed dead are encroaching on the walls,"
the archer reported.
"Can you take that necromancer out?"
"Not a chance. He's been using his minions as shields, and they're too hardy for me to... Wait, he's personally going to the base of the wall."
A magic user who willingly threw himself into the front lines like that could only mean one thing. He was about to unleash an ultimate skill. Since this man's ability was unknown, it immediately sent the elven officers into high alert. However, they were unable to pass orders down the chain of command fast enough for the defenders to react, and the white-robed man reached the foot of the stone wall unharmed. The alchemical fires and poisonous fumes that had been started by the fort's defenders had already subsided or been cleared away. The Empire's soldiers were wary of approaching this section of the wall again, so the corpse commander had no cover from the army. He didn't need it, though. The man's towering death knights used their huge shields to form a mobile bunker around their master, sheltering him from the rain of attacks that came from above. Although he lost about a quarter of his minions getting this far, he reached his goal without much difficulty. He raised his right arm and placed a pale hand on the chipped, battered, and scorched surface of the walls. He then let out a low voice, almost like a whisper.
"The goal of all life is death."
In the next instant, everything within 15 meters of him died. It wasn't just the elves within range of his ultimate skill, either. Even things that were not technically alive were granted death. Armor and weapons eroded into oblivion while the ground and stone around him turned to sand. Even part of his own undead platoon succumbed to the effects of the ultimate skill and collapsed into inanimate piles of ash. The very air became stagnant with anti-life to the point that even the person that brought about this world of ultimate decay started to choke on it. The necromancer, who was not completely exempt from the effects of his own ability, collapsed to one knee. The death knights left just outside the range of his ultimate skill ran to his side to provide cover. He heard thumping and clanging noises overhead as numerous attacks bounced off their heavy shields and armor.
"Ow! That hurt!"
In the next instant, he heard a high-pitched, childish voice that sent him on high alert. It was clearly audible over the chaotic noise of the battle around him, but he neither saw nor felt any nearby living beings. He quickly dismissed those words as the enemy using some kind of trickery to unsettle him. Rangers, for instance, commonly used whisper wind to distract an enemy during combat. The experienced necromancer wouldn't fall for such a basic ruse. He stood unsteadily, using his staff to support his weakened body. Looking up from the sandy ground and peering through the gaps between his minions, he confirmed that the walls before him had collapsed to leave a gigantic, gaping hole in the fort's defenses. He smiled under his mask as his mission had been completed. With his part in the battle over, all that was left was to fall back from the front lines, collect his pay, and gather new recruits from the soldiers that signed their bodies over to him. It wasn't difficult to find military types who preferred to have their remains continue to serve the Empire rather than being left to rot in the ground. However, the Holy Necromancer would have to actually make it back to safety before he could cash in on his investment. The man let out a shrill yell in response to the sudden, sharp pain in both his feet. Looking down in a panic, he saw something had pierced clean through them from below, effectively nailing him to this spot. How was such a thing possible? Everything underneath his position should have turned to ash and sand. Whatever traps the elves might have laid should have ceased to function, regardless of the magic they might have held. Even high-level monsters would wither away unless they were practically overflowing with vitality. The man's high-speed thought processes cut off as he coughed, gasping for air. He felt weak and dizzy, far worse than the after-effects of Final Goal, his ultimate skill, should have been. His limbs felt cold and his body grew heavy as he realized both his HP and MP were rapidly dropping. Whatever had pierced his feet sucked the blood straight out of him, leaving the man without the strength to free himself. In a fit of calculated panic, he mentally commanded his death knights to cut off his legs at the knees, which they did without hesitation. The man stifled the screams of pain as their ivory blades cleaved through his lower limbs. Separated from his feet, he fell over backwards into the waiting hands of his hallowed dead, who carried him away with all due haste. He reached for the rejuvenating potion on his belt. It was a high-class mixture that could be called the ultimate healing elixir. It was powerful enough to fully restore a living being to pristine condition in seconds, including growing back lost limbs. Its main downside was that a single dose would shave off several years from one's natural lifespan, but the necromancer didn't hesitate to bring the mixture to his lips. Moments later, the ivory-colored troop of death knights crumbled into piles of dust and bones, which blended into the yellow sand underneath. However, their master was nowhere to be found. All that was left of him were a pair of pierced shoes, a white robe stained red, and a trail of bloodied sand connecting the two points. An uncorked crystal vial lay on the ground, its pink contents draining away into the sand. It was as if the man's body had disappeared into thin air. It was the price he paid for carelessly harming a dryad's precious roots. Part 2.
Morgana, did those dryads make a move just now?
The angry visage of Prefect Vera stared accusingly at the calm crystal's image of the beastkin who was supposed to keep those children in check. She saw the girl turn her head around and heard her repeat the question. The redhead seemingly got her answer as she turned her attention back to the elf.
Castelia says she got upset and drank the man that hurt her roots.
Vera blinked a few times in surprise. She could immediately understand how the necromancer's large-scale attack might have caused the dryad to retaliate on reflex. That much was obvious. It was that other bit that confused her.
Drank?
Vera asked incredulously.
Yes, ma'am. Something about nutrients? So she absorbed his body while leaving nothing behind? I think so. She's not very good at explaining things.
I see. Well, we likely haven't been found out, but make sure you keep them in line, okay?
Even Fayhorn, who had just reported on the necromancer's mysterious disappearance, failed to see what went on with all the undead covering that VIP's retreat. It was therefore safe to assume the Empire's spotters were just as dumbfounded.
Yes, ma'am.
The prefect cut the connection and returned to the problem at hand. While losing two of their trump cards this early had definitely been a heavy blow for the Empire, they still managed to penetrate the fortress defenses much sooner than anticipated. The Republic planned to wear the enemy down a lot more before that happened, but that was just how powerful ultimate skills were. If applied correctly, they could drastically change the course of an entire war, let alone a single battle. The upside was that Operation Honey Trap involved letting the enemy pour into the fort anyway, though the Republic couldn't just open the gates and let them in. The invaders needed to remain oblivious to the nature of the nasty surprise the defenders had in store for them. This meant the Legionnaires and conscripts had to clash with the Imperials head-on. Many Republic troops would doubtlessly perish, but as Fayhorn had pointed out time and again, the dryads would only be effective so long as they remained an unknown factor. The elves had only one shot at this, so they had to make it count. even if it meant sacrificing their people. Back at the breached wall turned to desert, the Imperial officers considered whether it was safe to rush in. The life-sapping air had cleared up, but the necromancer that caused it was nowhere to be seen. Although they found the latter to be quite unsettling, the lack of knowledge wasn't going to get them any war contributions. Having two of their living weapons eliminated so soon was unfortunate, but the attackers definitely had the upper hand. VIPs aside, casualties on both sides seemed to be relatively equal thus far. This was good news for the numerically superior Empire. Even if the defenders had a more favorable position, the invaders' superior military would clearly win out. Seeing little reason to hesitate, the order was given and the Imperial troops rushed over the dried-up sands and through the crumbled section of the wall. As they were about to pour in, however, they met resistance.
Grit your teeth and say your prayers, you blithering gomerals!
Angry, inebriated, heavily armed, dwarf-shaped resistance. Hilda gave a war cry that carried clearly across the noisy battlefield, and everyone that heard it felt its effects. Your body trembles before the tempest of rage. The effectiveness of physical attributes is reduced by 25% for the next 15 minutes. The invading infantry felt rattled down to their very cores. Their movements grew noticeably more sluggish as each individual felt both their equipment and their breathing grow heavier. Suddenly losing a quarter of the benefits bestowed to them by their strength, dexterity, agility, and endurance rendered the vanguard confused and shaken on top of being severely weakened. The tempest of rage has swallowed you up. The effectiveness of physical attributes is increased by 25% for the next 15 minutes. The Republic's forces, on the other hand, let off a unified war cry as they felt their bodies well up with power. Elves, humans, and dwarves clad in shining silverite armor rushed out to meet the Empire's charge, their eyes glowing with an unearthly red light. Tight at their head was Hilda, whose blue tabard had been dyed white just for the occasion. She leapt a good 10 meters through the air and swung down with a massive axe taller than her.
Cleave!
The blade collided with the ground, sending out a shockwave of red light that dug a 5-meter-long trench through it. Needless to say, any humans who stood in its path found themselves slain without being able to do anything about it. Hilda didn't even bat an eye under her spiked helmet. She merely lifted the weapon up onto her shoulder with one hand and dashed forward, swinging it in a wide arc. Multiple men fell by the wayside every time her weapon moved, the bloodthirsty blade cutting clean flesh, bone, and metal alike. She kept forcing her way deeper into the Empire's ranks like a blender as she let the red haze overtake her. No steel weapon could reach her, but spells and various projectiles flew at her and chipped away at her formidable vitality. However, inflicting damage on a berserker simply made them more dangerous. This sort of environment was where the job truly shone. To make matters worse for her enemy, the magic weapon Hilda wielded replenished her lost vitality by absorbing the lifeblood of its victims, turning the dwarf into a perpetual carousel of death. The sheer terror her blood-soaked form inspired could not be understated. Even the allies following in her wake trembled at the thought of even getting near her. Well, all except one of them. An oddly gleeful cry came out from a small, mithril frame. Fizzy had decided to take this chance to further advance her metal golem and paladin jobs. Though her metallic constitution seemed to exclude her from receiving the benefits of the Tempest of Rage, she would not fail to teach these canned meatbags just how inferior they were to her. For once, it wasn't just her narcissistic tendencies talking.
Get out there and score some points with the military, but retreat the instant your survival is at stake.
Those had been the orders given to her by her hero, and she would follow them to the letter. The humans stood little chance in close combat against a mithril golem that was faster, stronger, and tougher. Her small size made it difficult to target her as she bashed the people around her into a bloody pulp from the ground up. Knees were smashed, spines were crushed, heads were squished, and groins were mercilessly targeted by her trusty wrench. She was entirely within her element, a champion of chaos navigating a sea of violence and slaughter. As she did so, Fizzy began to somewhat understand why Boxy liked killing humans so much. There was just something special about it. Maybe it was that subtly unique way their skulls caved in, or maybe that they were responsible for turning her former life into a nightmare. Perhaps it was the fact that there were just so many of them to barrel through. Whatever the case, there was no denying that personally taking part in this battle filled her with a thrill that fighting prisoners and monsters in the arena couldn't compete with. Still, the Radiant Construct was careful to not let herself get carried away. Sure, she had her fun, but made sure not to go as deep into enemy lines as Hilda was. Her shiny frame would make her too much of a target. For the first time in weeks, the Paladin resisted the urge to show off and blended in with the rank and file as much as she could. Fizzy might have made a name for herself in the arena circuit, but out here she was just another of the thousands of Republic troops doing their part to defend their homeland. She was aided in this endeavor by the way the situation rapidly deteriorated into an all-out brawl. Combatants fell on both sides as spells and arrows flew over and between them. The counterattack the Republic launched would only last as long as Hilda's ultimate skill persisted. Ultimately, it was nothing more than a smokescreen that allowed the defenders to inflict the most damage while suffering the least casualties before pulling back. The question was whether or not that dwarf actually planned to pull back. The way she pushed forward made one think she had no intention of doing so. She kept cleaving her way deeper into the Empire's ranks as if she planned on single-handedly slaughtering every single one of them. Looking at the trail of carnage she left in her wake made it seem like she was entirely capable of doing just that. Unless, of course, someone of comparable strength stood in her way. A clear gong-like sound rang out, and the dwarf was blown several meters backwards. She landed on her feet and skidded across the blood-soaked ground as she came to a stop several steps from her previous position. Her dented helmet landed somewhere behind her with a dull sound as she shook her now exposed head to recover from the unexpected blow.
Ugh! Got blood drunk again, didn't I?
She grumbled as she took in her surroundings. Going full berserker turned one into a force to be reckoned with, but it also made them lose sight of their surroundings. This was how Hilda found herself neck-deep in Imperial territory, far away from the walls of Fort Yemen and with enemy soldiers surrounding her. None of them seemed keen to approach her, despite having their weapons drawn and trained on her, forming a circle a few dozen meters wide. The reason they had suddenly stopped dead was to avoid getting in the way of a certain someone that actually had a chance at stopping the dwarf's rampage for good. A certain someone that Hilda was surprised, delighted, and enraged to see. The one who had just knocked her helmet off was the mysterious, lightly armored VIP Fayhorn spotted earlier. Her ashen leather armor was covered by a bright blue tabard with a golden handprint on her left shoulder. In her hands was a black, plain-looking metal staff with gilded decorations on either end. Attached to her back were a pair of ethereal angelic wings, similar yet subtly different from Lictor's, which beat slowly as she hovered slightly above the ground. The hood that obscured her features before was lowered to reveal a beautiful yet cold expression befitting of an ice queen, framed by shoulder length, raven black hair that fluttered slightly in the breeze kicked up by her wings. It was a look the dwarf was intimately familiar with.
Well, butter me butt and call me a biscuit.
She smiled fiercely in her fighting stance.
How you been, Jane?
The woman planted her feet on the ground as her glowing wings disappeared.
Hilda,
she said flatly.
Fancy seeing you here. Had a feeling you didn't bite the big one like I heard. But I didn't think you'd turn military.
The angelic woman didn't reply, but merely assumed her own stance. She stood on one leg, her other raised and bent at the knee. She gripped her staff with her left hand and held it behind her back while extending her right palm forward and upward, as if asking for a cup of sugar.
Cold as usual, eh?
The dwarf continued.
Still, can I wait to see Shoestrap's face when he finds out you're still kicking?
In the next instant, Jen shifted a few centimeters to her left, and a phantasmal arrow pierced through the space her forehead occupied mere moments prior.
Ah, too late for that, eh?
Several more arrows flew at her,
but she idly plucked them out of the air, catching the projectiles between her fingers. Monks were infamous for their ability to handle projectile attacks with ease, and this one was so advanced that Fayhorn's bow seemed useless against her. Still, the elf ranger wouldn't be himself if he didn't test his old comrade. Both Fayhorn and Hilda instantly recognized this woman as Jennifer Jackson, who used to be a member of their adventuring team along with Lictor the Paladin. She had left them after a particularly bad falling out decades ago, yet looked exactly the same. This was due to her timeless body, a high-level monk skill that, among other things, allowed her to retain her youthful vigor and appearance despite her advanced age.
What's with the fancy mark on your shoulder? You a big shot or something over there? Knew you had it in ya, you fucking psycho.
The woman blushed slightly in response despite her unflinching expression, showing she was still both immune to sarcasm and weak to compliments.
Come on, Jen. You must be at least a little happy to see me, right?
Jennifer is dead, spoke the woman in a deadpan voice. I am Zone of the Gilded Hand. Nothing more, nothing less.
Ah, they even gave you a fancy code name, eh? Well then, Zone, let's see if you can still swing that stick around as well as you used to.
Hilda leapt forward, swinging her unreasonably sized axe in a wide diagonal arc. Her opponent didn't even flinch as she struck it with her staff, knocking the heavy lump of metal off course and causing it to dig into the ground. She swung her fist around, aiming at Hilda's head. The dwarf raised her shoulder, deflecting the blow with her armor while she pulled back her weapon. She swung it once more, but the monk leapt over and brought her staff down on her head, which was barely deflected by the haft of Hilda's axe. The dwarf pushed against that staff with all her might, intending to drive her axe's blade into Zone's neck at near point-blank range. Her target unfurled her wings and retreated into the sky before that happened. She flapped her feathers a few times to gain some altitude before swooping in with a sweep of her staff. It was the same attack that had taken Hilda's helmet off, except the now-in-control berserker sidestepped it with minimal movements. Out of the corner of her eye, she saw Zone deflect another barrage from Fayhorn with little difficulty.
Damn, cursed the ranger under his breath. It really is her, isn't it?
Back on his perch, the High Elf did his best to cover Hilda's reckless advance by picking off the enemy magic users targeting her. And then that problem child showed up. The woman he knew as Jennifer had grown immensely in the years since they had last seen her, but that troublesome personality of hers seemed to still be intact. The fact she managed to rank up in that time frame was nothing short of impressive, which made a part of him happy for his old ally. No, former ally. Whatever their relationship might have been before, she was now an enemy. Come to think of it, she was most likely the one who had saved those griffins from his arrows following the hillside ambush about a week ago. Only a monk could be that adept at nullifying a ranger's attacks, and Jennifer was clearly among the best of them. Still, that didn't mean she had the luxury to deflect his arrows and go toe-to-toe with Hilda at the same time. She wouldn't stand a chance so long as he provided covering fire while his partner on the ground did her thing. Unfortunately, there was a lot more going on than three veteran adventurers beating the crap out of each other. Fayhorn saw the comm crystal at his feet light up, indicating that Silas was trying to get in touch with him. The ranger hesitated for a moment, but he still answered it with one hand while keeping a trained eye on Hilda and Jennifer's duel.
What is it, Silas?
We have trouble, the officer stated urgently. Air units coming in from the south. We need you to handle it.
It wasn't a direction the ranger had a line of sight on. The enemy was assaulting the fort from the west, and he was currently on a north-facing branch. As such, there was a colossal tree trunk between himself and those new targets. He would have to relocate, and that would take time that Hilda might not have.
Can it wait?
The ranger asked hopefully.
No, it really can't.
Of course it couldn't. The fact that Underwood was contacting him meant it must have been a threat that nobody else could handle. Fayhorn sighed and decided to trust that wrecking ball of a dwarf to handle things on her own. At least until he was done dealing with this new situation.
All right, I'm on it.
The ranger put the blue cube away in his pocket and ran along the sheer side of the hilt tree.
He kicked off its surface and grabbed onto a vine dangling from above. He used his momentum to swing over to the next vine, and then the next, as he made his way around the side of the massive trunk. He relocated to another branch, this one a bit lower in altitude, which gave him a good view of both the battle and the approaching threat.
"You gotta be shitting me," he mumbled under his breath.
"Aerial units," was Silas putting it lightly. The six griffins he saw were one thing, but their lead flyer was a different story entirely. It was a gigantic creature that was several sizes bigger than the others. It had a long neck and tail, a massive torso with four legs ending in claws, and a pair of ridiculously large, leathery wings. Its entire body was covered in shining green scales, and it had thick black spikes running down the length of its spine.
"What's a freaking dragon doing here?"
he screamed at nobody in particular. His eyes gave him the answer to that frustrating question. There was someone riding atop the mighty beast, a stocky figure wrapped in brown furs and a pair of goggles to shield him from the wind. The massive black beard flowing from his chin fluttered around either side of his neck, making it quite obvious as to who he was. Well, it was the thing that he was riding that really gave it away, but that was beside the point.
Silas, he reported into the comm crystal. "That's Thorgrim the Dragon Tamer, isn't it?"
One of the few monster tamers to reach level 100, and the only person in recent history who was able to fully control the prideful creatures that stood at the pinnacle of the monster world. Having to face a dragon was bad enough, but a creature under a monster tamer's control was always stronger than a wild one. The added direction and cunning of an experienced adventurer made them tricky to bring down. The only consolation was the tiny size of the dragon's horns showed it was still a juvenile.
"Can you take him?"
Underwood asked curtly.
"What, by myself? Where's Imril?"
"She's engaging the Black Tower on the field. She's trying to keep him from activating his ultimate skill."
Fayhorn scanned the ground and immediately located the site of their battle. They were just under the walls, immediately south of where the sandy hole was. The two of them exchanged lightning spells with great intensity and were evenly matched. The Black Tower appeared to be quite adept at magic, despite his intimidating frame and bulging muscles.
"So, can you do it or not?"
Silas insisted.
"Not a chance. I don't have nearly enough MP to kill a dragon, let alone one controlled by a monster tamer.
So, if you had the MP, you could do it?
Maybe. But I'll get potion sickness before that happens."
The ranger never could handle alchemical supplements. He could only drink 3 or 4 potions a day before the debilitating condition settled in, and he had already used 2 of them.
"Good enough. Stand by."
Underwood's image disappeared, even though the comm crystal was still active.
"What do you mean, good enough? Silas!"
Fayhorn shouted.
"Hey, mister!"
A green girl's head with hair-like grass poked out of the branch he stood on, almost literally between his legs. It caused him to let out an uncharacteristic scream of surprise as he instinctively leapt back a few steps.
Castilia, right?"
"Yep. Mummy says you need some food, so here you go."
A number of leafy blue vines sprouted from around the elf and grew straight upwards, then wrapped themselves around his waist. The ranger had no idea what was going on, but this was clearly part of Underwood's plan, so he let the little plant lady do what she willed. He then felt something flowing into him. Looking at his status, he saw his nearly depleted MP recovering at a mind-boggling rate.
"Oh, I see."
His face lit up.
"Clever. Very clever."
If dryads could suck the mana out of living things, then it was only natural they could return it as well. However, the influx of energy didn't stop when it hit maximum, and his current MP went over his capacity. The overabundance of magical energy in his body caused his joints to tense up, his temple to throb, and his chest to burn painfully. The magical energy would likely kill him if this carried on. The difference between medicine and poison was in the dosage, after all.
Could you tone it down a bit? Wait, where'd she go?"
The dryad, it would seem, had already departed. Like it or not, Fayhorn had the MP he wanted. Now, he just had to make sure he spent it all before it made his heart explode. worst-case scenario, he'd just cut off the vines with the dagger on his belt. Doing so would probably piss the dryad off a little, but he had a feeling she wouldn't exactly stop feeding him on her own. Based on what he'd heard, restraint wasn't a virtue that dryads possessed. Without waiting for his symptoms to get any worse, the High Elf went down on one knee and leveled his bow against the targets in the distance.
Hunter's mark, strafe, wind-imbued arrows, deadshot, adrenaline rush.
He activated numerous skills in rapid succession from both his ranger and rogue jobs, and then took a deep breath.
Turret stance. Snipe.
The pain in his limbs and head gradually went away as he started spending his overabundant MP. His hands moved at a speed that would be difficult for anyone to follow, turning into blurs as they repeatedly pulled back and released the bowstring. The weapon, his body, and even the branch under his feet shook violently from the excessive rapid fire, clocking at about 200 shots per minute. He first targeted the dragon, hitting it in the snout with a dozen arrows before it could react by weaving and dodging. Once the enemy knew they were under fire, he changed targets to the 6 griffins. Those were shot down in as little as 20 seconds and fell to the ground resembling gigantic pincushions. He turned his aim back to the approaching dragon and kept the constant stream of blue lights trained on it. As expected, however, he wasn't doing much. The dragon bobbed and weaved at a speed that belied its large body, making it excessively difficult to land clean hits on it. At least half the shots missed completely, while those that hit mostly bounced harmlessly off its tough scales. Trying to target the dwarf strapped to his back proved to be a futile effort, as the spikes along the beast's spine served to give him a surprisingly good amount of cover. The dragon's movements were also highly chaotic, making it impossible to nail the relatively tiny owner at this distance. Besides, the dwarf had probably linked his vitality with the monster under his command, meaning either both died or neither did. Still, damage steadily accumulated on the great beast as its scales chipped away and its wings filled with tiny holes. The wounds stitched themselves shut with worrying speed, but the beast's regenerative abilities couldn't keep up. If things kept going like this, Fayhorn might have actually stood a chance. Unfortunately, the temporary effects of his various skills started wearing off, and both his rate of fire and accuracy suffered. The burden he put on his body wasn't helping things either. His bones creaked, his hands bled, and his muscles screamed. But he didn't stop. He couldn't stop. By this time, a full minute of his barrage had passed, and the dragon was within 300 meters of his position. Smoke rose from its nostrils as it let out a gigantic ball of green flames aimed directly at the ranger. He didn't panic and just kept shooting dead center at the incoming projectile. The spectral arrows from his bow plowed through the flames, dispersing the fireball into a far less dangerous shower of sparks and smoke in a matter of seconds. Those were precious seconds the ranger didn't have to spare. He had to bring the beast down before it got close enough to incinerate the fort's defenders, but shortening the distance also allowed Fayhorn to change tactics. He ceased the movement of his hands and let out a few ragged breaths. After that much too short breather, he adjusted his stance and waited for the dragon's nostrils to flare up again before activating his ultimate skill, albeit in a slightly different fashion.
Turret stance. Burst shot.
Burst shot was a bow-based martial art with relatively low range, high MP consumption, and minimal armor penetration. However, it was the most destructive of the techniques granted by a ranger's marksman skill. As for why Fayhorn had chosen this particular martial art, it was to exploit one of the dragon's two known weaknesses. The first was that their muscles were actually disproportionately weak in relation to their bulk. A dragon's physical might was formidable from a person's perspective, but only because of the sheer size and mass difference. If a dragon and a human were in the same weight category, then the latter would be able to overpower it in a contest of raw strength. Of course, even if a human that massive actually existed, the dragon would just back off and burn them to a crisp using their deadliest weapon, their breath attacks. However, using those was also how they revealed their other key weakness. A dragon's scales made up one of the toughest natural armors in the world. They deflected both physical and magical attacks with ease, and damaging them was an ordeal in and of itself. The only thing in Fayhorn's repertoire that could even scratch them was snipe, and the most a burst shot could do was maybe leave a scorch mark. A dragon's insides, however, were frightfully vulnerable. Obviously, landing an attack from inside the beast was pretty much impossible without getting eaten. Unless, of course, they opened their jaws wide for some other reason. The green fireball left the dragon's maw, just as dozens of red-tinted arrows plowed into it and lodged themselves into the back of its throat. The sudden jolt of massive pain caused the beast to stop its advance and recoil while grabbing onto its snout with its clawed, webbed fingers. A heartbeat later, the arrows inside its mouth exploded violently, ripping its throat to shreds. The beast let out a piercing howl as it plummeted towards the ground with black smoke coming out of its jaws. It crashed into the ground with a thundering impact that the elf could feel all the way up on his perch, the beast's final breath exploding into green flames somewhere above him. Fayhorn's victorious celebration was cut short by him coughing up blood. He hadn't realized it, but the MP influx overpowered his expenditure ever since his rate of fire dropped and his body was starting to suffer for it. He quickly took his knife out and cut away the mana-imbuing vines. He panted heavily and frantically, allowing his body to steadily release the excess MP into the air through uneven breathing. A few moments of hyperventilating calmed him down enough to finally realize that the comm crystal at his feet was ringing again. Not knowing how long it had been doing that, he grasped it as quickly as his bloodied hand would allow and answered it.
Silas,
he smirked.
I got the—
You have incoming!
No sooner had Underwood uttered those words when the exhausted ranger felt a presence rapidly approaching him. He looked to his right just in time to see something long, thin, and black hurtling towards his face. There was a dull sound as the metal object made contact with his head and sent him flying off the branch. His skull most definitely cracked, and he lost vision in one eye, but he was still able to make two things out as he fell. One was the winged figure of Jennifer, the one responsible for knocking him off his perch. Though the emotionless mask she wore was new to him, the cold glare in her yellow eyes was all too familiar. The other thing he noticed was the aftermath of the dragon's last fireball, which he failed to completely defuse. His lethal assault had thrown off the creature's aim, causing it to bathe the hilt tree's upper canopy in emerald green flames. He was sure the dryad was in pain now, as a dragon's flames were capable of scorching anything from existence.
Ah, that poor kid.
Time seemed to slow down as he plummeted, his mind drifting off to the beastkin who would have to deal with the distraught child and keep her in line. The girl that showed more promise than any other student he had ever seen. The girl that suffered far worse than any person should have had to endure. The girl who had the strength of will to smile and seek happiness, despite all she'd been through. The girl that was sure to carry on his teachings and his legacy. Granted, he still had his suspicions that there was something quite off about her, but it was ultimately a good thing that he never learned the truth.
I just know she'll be an incredible mother one day.
It meant that his final thoughts before he hit the ground and lost his life were thoroughly happy. Part 3. A blood-stained axe swung downward, and a black staff intercepted it. It hit the high-speed attack from the side, causing it to change course and miss its target entirely. Just like before, Zone used that gap to close in and thrust a palm out at Hilda. The dwarf countered it with a punch of her own. Gauntlet clashed against bare skin, yet the noise produced was a metallic clang. Still, Zone lost in the contest of strength and was pushed back, which gave the dwarf enough of a gap to reposition her axe and take a wide vertical swing at her midsection. The monk leapt backwards to dodge, but the axe still managed to cut a shallow wound across her abdomen, her eyes wide open in shock at the unexpected speed of the attack. Zone took a brief moment to reevaluate her opponent as her feet skidded across the ground. The dwarf in front of her was much more dangerous than she initially thought. Or rather, It would be more accurate to say she had underestimated her based on the image from her memories. She knew that even if Hilda was a hothead who rarely considered the consequences of her actions, the old bat's mind was like a steel trap when it came to combat. Although she let her anger run wild at first, she now had full control over it. Hilda honed her supernatural rage into a weapon and was pointing it directly at Zone's neck like an invisible guillotine. Considering the berserker only got stronger as she took damage, the dwarf would become more troublesome as the battle went on. In direct contrast to her was the monk. Hers was a job that required stillness of heart and calmness of mind. It read the opponent's flow and became one with it, like a blade of grass swaying in the wind. However, this dwarf was no mere gust of air, but a raging tornado that threatened to rip out the very soil itself. Her attacks seemed completely random, yet each one was a deadly strike that would most likely be fatal if taken head-on. The fact she managed to rend through the human's dragonhide armor with so little resistance was proof enough of that. In short, Zone had almost instantaneously come to the decision that she could not take Hilda without revealing her trump card. The human in front of Hilda chanted something under her breath. Her yellow eyes glowed with a serene, cyan light, and a swirl of similarly colored energy enveloped her. It draped around her like a transparent film, a second skin that perfectly matched the contours of her body and her armor. The dwarf's fierce, toothy grin, a clear sign that she enjoyed the fight, only grew wider in response. Her opponent had activated some weird skill, perhaps her ultimate. There was no way the berserker wouldn't get even more fired up. Hilda prepared her axe for another attack, but Zone moved first this time. The monk dashed forward, spun around, and swung her staff downward with all her might. The sharp-eyed berserker sidestepped the wide swing, which crashed into the hard-packed dirt, kicking up a small explosion of dust. The dwarf immediately recognized it as Zone having put all of her power into a single blow. She could already tell from their exchanges that their physical strength was comparable, and she only came out on top because of the added weight of her armor. However, such a careless move was completely unlike Zone. It was an attack that put her all into offense and left nothing for defense. If she was in the dwarf's class in the consortium, a performance like that would earn her a harsh reprimand. But this was a battlefield, and the punishment for mistakes like those were one's life. A verdict Hilda executed without hesitation as she sent her axe flying at the monk's wide-open neck. A spectral, cyan-colored form bearing Zone's shape leapt out of the monk's body and swung her version of the black staff upward, perfectly intercepting the horizontal blow and redirecting its path, so it only sliced off a few hairs. The dwarf didn't miss a beat, using her sideways momentum to swing her weapon around with a spin and deliver another blow, even faster than the last one. When she laid eyes on Zone once more, she saw the monk swinging her own staff at the dwarf's head. Her spectral self once again leapt out and brilliantly parried the axe while her physical one smashed into the dwarf's left arm, which she had raised in defense. The armor absorbed much of that impact, but the weapon infused with her ki still sent shockwaves of pain through the berserker's body. Hilda recoiled slightly, giving time for her opponent to take another quick swing, which was blocked by the haft of her axe. The dwarf shifted her body forward and kicked out with her stubby leg, only to see a ghostly foot shoot out of the human and intercept her own with a metal clang. Although their power was similar, the dwarf's much heavier body was still able to win out and push Zone away from her, creating some space between them. With just that much, Hilda could grasp the nature of her former teammate's ultimate skill, Spirit Guardian. The dwarf might not have known its name, but her veteran mind quickly deduced its effects. That ghostly presence would automatically deflect incoming attacks, allowing the user to put all her energy into crushing her opponent. It was like fighting two people at the same time, a simultaneous application of one's offense and defense. Well, two could play at that game.
Rearm!
Chanted the dwarf. Her massive axe disappeared in a flash of white light, followed by a few other flashes around her body. When the impromptu light show ended a few moments later, Hilda was holding a completely different set of armaments. Her right hand clutched a bearded mithril war axe with a long handle. while her left one grasped at a bizarre red and yellow striped mace closer in appearance to a club. It wasn't just her weapons that had changed, either. A small, gold-rimmed buckler was securely strapped to her left forearm, and her previously exposed head now sported a bulky helmet. This new headgear was made out of interlocking steel plates and clearly wasn't part of the same set as her bloodied and battered full plate armor. Zone's cold glare became razor-sharp as she finally realized how that vertically challenged, reckless nutjob became such a refined combatant. Although an uninitiated mind couldn't spot the subtle differences between them, each melee-focused job had their way of fighting. A lot of it overlapped, but each of them had their own focus, their own area of expertise. Warriors trained their bodies and endurance. Berserkers honed their fighting spirit. Monks mastered the art of mind over matter. Paladins empowered themselves with divine energies. Rogues sharpened their cunning, and blade dancers perfected their motion and rhythm. But the job that truly honed one's blade, the one that was focused on the tools of war first and foremost, was the arms master. An experienced arms master could use every weapon conceivable with an equal degree of mastery and could move in cumbersome plate armor with the finesse of a dancer on a stage. Their skills maximized the performance of their equipment, amplifying the strength of the various enchantments that a magic item could hold. Their approach to combat was as varied and versatile as all of the different arms and armor at their disposal, and their power scaled in direct proportion to the depth of their pockets. It was a prestigious occupation that required serious connections to even acquire, let alone utilize fully. So, it was a surprise that Hilda had access to it. The arms master job was supposed to be a closely guarded secret of the dwarf-ruled Horkensaft Kingdom. Much like the spies of the Empire, it was something only available to select, elite individuals who had the trust and respect of the country's leadership. These individuals would, in turn, enter into a life-binding agreement prepared by a high-level scribe's contract magic skill, which prevented them from passing the job on to others under penalty of instant death. In summary, it was extremely difficult to find an arms master outside of Horkensaft's elite military forces. Yet, the person in front of Zone was undoubtedly one of those. The rearm skill that she had shown off was a dead giveaway. It was an arms master's signature ability, allowing one to keep their personal arsenal within a pocket dimension. It was smaller in capacity when compared to an enchanter's item box and only limited to weapons and armor specifically, but allowed the user to instantly change their loadout as the situation demanded.
Now then,
Hilda lowered and widened her stance.
Shall we give this a try?
She dashed forward and swung her newly equipped axe at Zone. The spirit guardian deflected it with ease, while the monk's physical staff bounced off the dwarf's buckler. The mace in that shielded hand hurtled towards the monk's head, and while the spirit guardian successfully parried, the near simultaneous follow-up from the axe on the other side forced Zone to block it with her staff. The bearded axe, however, moved forward at the last second, causing the shafts of the two weapons to collide. Hilda pulled on her axe with all her might, and the weapon's long, curved blade hooked around the monk's staff, pulling it and its wielder closer to the berserker-come-armsmaster. The angelic human expertly twisted her staff around and pulled on it to unlatch it from her opponent's weapon. She managed to release it almost immediately, but she still found herself literally face-to-face with Hilda. While the spirit guardian kept that heavy mace at bay, the dwarf's armored forehead collided with Zone's. And in doing so, the dwarf set off the impact-sensitive trigger in the helmet Fizzy had custom-made for her. What followed was a thunderous explosion, the force of which blasted Zone's relatively light body several meters through the air. Her dragonhide armor dulled the impact and protected her body, but her exposed face was left covered in cuts and gashes from the shrapnel. She breathed heavily for the first time since this battle started, possibly also the first time in months. The mind she tried to keep as still and unfeeling as a pond was now rattled and disturbed by the absurdity that was Hilda. The dwarf, on the other hand, had barely moved from her spot. The remnants of her helmet-shaped bomb fell off her smoldering head, with the only sign of injury being a fresh trickle of blood running down her temple. even if that helmet carried a shaped charge that directed most of the explosive force forward, it was impossible for Hilda to not take damage from it. Her head might have gone missing altogether if it wasn't for her absurd vitality. The craggy skin skill she had obtained as part of her rank up into a Stonekin dwarf had also helped. The ability reduced damage taken from non-magical sources, which included an artificer's explosive devices. All in all, Hilda's opponent clearly got the worst part of that blast, but it was the process that led up to it that shook Zone. That fast, compact, and calculated combination of blows were completely unlike the axe-wielding maniac she'd been fighting until then. It was almost the polar opposite of Hilda's natural fighting style, but one far more troublesome to deal with. The dwarf undoubtedly understood the weakness in Zone's ultimate skill. Although the Spirit Guardian could block incoming strikes with all of the monk's speed, strength, and expertise, it could only focus on one blow at a time. While huge singular swings were of no concern, it was possible to overwhelm the ethereal entity's defenses with rapid, consecutive, or simultaneous strikes. Zone herself could handle those well enough on her own, but doing so defeated the purpose of her ghost self being there. It was a good thing Fayhorn had stopped taking potshots at her, otherwise... The monk's eyes widened as she recalled that long-range